I'm Matt Godbolt.
And I'm Ben Rady.
And this is Two's Compliment, a programming podcast.
Hey, Ben.
Hey, Matt.
I am not convinced my levels are right here, so I apologize if the audio is awful on this. Something isn't going well here.
You think it's too quiet?
I think it's too quiet. I mean, how does it sound to you?
It sounds good to me.
All right, but I've turned the gain up here and it looks really... Okay, well, we'll go with that. Anyway, hi! Yeah. Hello. Are you doing, friend? This is a catastrophe for editing Matt, as we were just... during the opening jingle, we were taking the mickey out of editing Matt because he's a jerk. But that's fine because he's not here.
Yeah. The moment. I usually find that yesterday Ben is a jerk and tomorrow Ben is the most responsible person on the face of the earth.
He's
going to take care of everything because I'm
you know that thing?
Today.
Yeah, that's 100% how I see the world too. Yeah. So we had started this as we often do by chatting in a Google Meet before this, and then we were like, let's just record, let's do it. And then we had to switch out, and then unfortunately, because we're now using a separate recording system, that involves fiddling around with web browser settings and plugging in different microphones, everything, and now I can't even remember what it was we were talking about.
So when I just cut over to this, I was of course in the middle of writing a test because, you know, what else would I be doing?
Of course.
And I was saying how one of the things that I love to do is test my metrics.
That's right. You
had made a very interesting point about performance sensitive code and this technique. So do you recall what you said?
I do now. Thank you for being the responsible adult and remembering from 1 minute to the next what
tomorrow Ben is manifest today.
Yeah, it seems so. It seems so. So yeah, you had said that you were writing tests for the metrics in your code. And that's a fantastic thing to do because if you're relying on those metrics, you probably want to make sure they're right. And then I'd said for some areas of performant code, so certainly in C++ land, sometimes there isn't a seam for you to put an interface or some kind of like a measuring point in your regular code to write a test around. So like the classic example I can think of is if you've got a high performance like cache of information, that is like a software cache, just to be clear, then you want to be able to test whether or not you hit the cache or not. But that's not, the cache is there to be transparent, right? It's either there or whatever, or, you know, it fetches a value, or maybe it's more like a memoization cache. So, you know, it either computes a value or it returns the value that you did before. And the caller doesn't need to care about that. And you don't want to have to break your interface just to write a test. And you don't want to have to pass in a listener class that says, hey, on cache result, because that's all, you know, what it's not good for the design of your system. It's maybe not good for the performance. But you probably do want metrics about how often your cache is being hit. And if you're writing performant code, you've probably written a really relatively performant metric system.
Right. Yeah.
And then it becomes a natural way of measuring whether your code is testing the things that you're wanting. Like, am I getting a cache hit? Am I getting a cache miss? By looking at the metrics.
Yes.
And so that was where we were when we said, let's record this. And that's the end of the podcast. Thank you for listening, everybody.
Thanks, everybody. Outro music plays. No, and I mean, I think that this is a great specific example of a general thing, which I think we've talked about on the podcast before, of like, what does it mean to have testable code, right? What does it mean to have code that is testable? And there is a sort of a premise that is baked into all of this, and it's woven into like test-driven development and a bunch of other things, which is if you build software that has a nice interface for some definition of nice, it will be easy to test. And writing the tests helps you create that nice interface. And this is a specific example of that because the thing that's nice about this is the observability. We want to have code that is observable. We want to have code where we can know what it's doing. And the tests in this case is giving you like a very specific thing of like, I need to know if I hit the cache. You need to know that for the test. And you need to know that when you're running your software. And that is the same problem. It is the exact same problem. And so the tests are there to give you that.
Yeah, but I suppose specifically in this instance, like a not totally unreasonable API to your whatever this thing, cached thing is, mm-hmm. is that you return like a tuple of the thing that you got out of the cache and some status object that said, did I get it from the cache? Was it a hit? Was it a miss?
Sure.
Well, yeah. You know, that's a reasonable interface. In which case now...
You can also do it that way. Yeah.
Well, that's my point, right? That is a reasonable way to write this system. But very specifically, in oftentimes, if you're like in a very high performance kind of piece of code, that you by writing the interface that way, you have pessimized the case where you don't care if it was in the cache or not, which is the very common case. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you're forcing everything through the systems. But the metrics are something that are a sort of a side channel that mm-hmm. are something you still care about and are performant, and you're now using them to test the inner workings of something that should be transparent, and you in fact want it to be transparent. And I think there's sort of maybe you're saying those are the same things. I've just found it as being an interesting way of saying, like, there's some internal workings of a class mm-hmm. that I would like to be able to test, but I don't really want to expose it to the outside world. And I can't expose it to the outside world through either because the performance characteristics would be different, mm-hmm. but I can't directly expose it to the outside world. And so this metrics represents an indirect way of me accessing interesting mm-hmm. things that happened in my class.
Yeah, I kind of get what you're saying there, but I think it all hinges on the definition of outside world.
Right. Okay.
Like the caller of the code is let's live in a multiverse for a second here. The sure. caller of the code is one world, but another world is sort of you as an operator of the software. And the tests can stand in for both of those things. You don't have to do them all as one thing, right? The caller of the code can be like, yeah, I asked for this value, I got this value back, I'm not getting a tuple that indicates whether it was a cache hit or a cache miss or
because
some sort of other metadata that rides along with it, because I don't actually care about that, right? And I shouldn't have to care about that just for the purposes of testing to make sure that my caching system works. But you as an operator of that software, you as somebody who's going to be, you know, watching it run and making sure that the performance is good and making sure that the changes that you've made have taken place as you would have expected, need another dimension into the multiverse of ways to see what is going on. And the tests can stand in for that too. There is another actual aspect of this. I was just ranting to you earlier this week about this, actually, when we were at yeah. lunch. There is another aspect of this that I think holds here, and that is logging. Usually
right.
what people do is they have a logging system and they just dump things into the logs. You know, it's like, oh, I've got this variable here, I'll log this out or whatever it is, right? And, you know, it's the really unfortunate case when it's like, okay, yeah, we have the log statements in the code for when the terrible thing happens. And then you go and you look in the logs because the terrible thing has happened. And what you see is like the magic value is %s. Because your whatever logging thing that you set up didn't actually capture the value that you wanted because you thought it was templated and it wasn't, whatever it is that happened. And yeah. like the one in a million moment is come and gone and you're never going to see it again. Right. And so.
Are you about to write tests for logging is what you're about to
say. That is exactly what I'm saying. This is exactly what I'm saying is that I think that one of the benefits of structured logging is that you can approach it in the exact same way that we are talking about these metrics, right?
Right. So they are similar sounding things in this instance. It's just a different way of structured logging. And one is a counter, and the other one is maybe a sequence of events that you've logged.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly right. But it is exactly this thing of the tests are not just standing in for like the caller of the code as they usually do, but they are standing in for the sort of tomorrow you, who's a very responsible person and wants to know what their metrics are and what their logs are and wants to make sure that they're correct. And then you can also use both of those dimensions of kind of observability to understand what your code is doing and verify that it is correct, right? The tests yeah. can operate on both of those dimensions at the
right.
same time.
I mean, who among us hasn't written that warning statement, like, this is weird. And then, mm-hmm. you know, your test coverage says, hey, you never hit the this is weird log line. And you're like, oh, I should write a test for it. But realistically speaking, what am I going to do? All it does is log, this is weird.
Right, right.
And, you know, I'm sure you've done this before, you know, even with, you know, most logging systems and certainly ones that I've interacted with, you have a test fixture that can capture the log. So you can write it and then, but your assertion is something weak, like assert this is weird in captured.log.
Right.
And that's better than a kick in the teeth, but it is not ideal. And what you're saying is with a more print, you know, certainly in terms of the textual mapping and, you know, it makes your test quite brittle.
Right.
But if you can have a structured log, so I think we have talked about structured logging before, but do you want to just give us a quick recap of what you think of or what right now, because I know you're in the middle of it all, what you think of as structured logging?
Yeah, I mean, and I grant that people have differing takes on this, and I think you can do it in different ways. But I think that if I were to try to summarize all of the different approaches that I've seen that have been called structured logging, it is kind of like you alluded to it earlier. It is treating your logs as a stream of events, right? Sometimes multiple streams of events, like you can think of like the info logs as one stream and the error logs as a separate stream and the warning logs another stream, or you can mush them all together and have a heterogeneous thing. But the basic idea is that you are going to not think of your logs as I'm just puking some text out to standard error or standard out. It is, no, there's a stream of events that is coming out of my system and I can turn those into human readable logs if I want, but I can turn them into whatever I want because I'm a wizard and I have programming skills and I can transform a stream of events into anything. And so it solves a number of kind of problems. And one of them is this sort of case of like making sure that you are actually capturing the information in your logs that you think you are. Wow. Another one is this sort of case of like, well, how do I make sure that we are responding to this situation in which I want to do nothing. And in fact, the thing that sort of kicked off this whole conversation 10 minutes ago was me writing a test for a situation where I was skipping a trade that I wanted to ignore intentionally because it was being replayed, right? Like it was like, oh, I want to make sure this is idempotent. We've seen this trade already. I don't want to publish it again. So like the correct action is to do nothing, right? Now, in that case, I was making an assertion about a metric. But you could easily imagine that that could also be a log statement, and testing that nothing has happened is a very important thing to be able to do, right?
And more importantly, discriminating between the nothing has happened because I processed the event correctly and determined that nothing should happen, compared to you didn't call the process event function at all in your test, and therefore nothing happened, right?
Exactly.
So you can distinguish them when the nothing that happened is actually something did happen. The something was I bumped a metric saying ignored events ++, or I logged warning this event was skipped because it's a replay, or whatever it is that you've done. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense there. It certainly gives you a lot more, lets you sleep at night a bit more comfortably because, you know, again, how many times have we written tests where you realize this test is passing and then you're like scratching your head like, wait, it's not being run, is it?
That's what
I've misspelled test as T set. And now my system that looks for only the word test is not actually running any of these files at all. Right.
Right. Right. The test where it's like you can comment out all of the code that you thought you were testing and the test still passed because there's no assertion in it, right? It's just like run some code and hope an exception doesn't happen, right? Like those are very unfulfilling tests.
Right.
And so
this gives you a way of measuring some of those types of events or quantifying them and saying that this, gathering confidence that actually you are doing the thing that you thought that you were doing.
Yeah. Another thing that you can do with structured logging, which has another sort of flavor of this, is, you know, you have these moments sometimes where you're trying to test something and you're like, part of me just wants to like reach into the center of this class and pull out this state, but I don't want to really do that because that's going to break the encapsulation of the class, right? Like, you know, I want to be able to refactor this code. I want to be able to change things, certain things about this code without having to change the tests because that's what refactoring is. And I don't want to reach into the guts of this class because that'll make my test less valuable and make it so that I can't refactor. But I really want to know like what this value is. And so one of the things that you can do with structured logging, which I think is really interesting, is it gives you a conduit to sort of more carefully and selectively pull pieces of information out of the internals of a class in a way that doesn't expose all of the guts. It just sort of exposes like the one little piece of information that you want. And the example of this is like you're going to have a log statement that says like the queue size is 5, right? Well, it's like, I don't want to reach into the guts of the class and check to see what the queue size is. But like in the instances where it's important to log what the queue size is, I can use that as a way to confirm my suspicions about what it should be, right? And you can go another level deep with this if you want to, and I have, and I don't know if it's generally a good idea, but I think it's an interesting thing to talk about, which is when you have structured logs and you can find a way to do object serialization in those structured logs in a way that's not totally insane or sometimes just mildly insane, you can have complete objects that come out of there and right. go into your logging system and can be reconstituted later. And the one place where I think I have seen this done the least insane is with exceptions, right? Like you have, part of your logging system where if an exception occurs, you have a reasonably high confidence serialization system that allows you to capture that exception, maybe with some special cases in there to make sure it's not too big or contains like a reference to like a, you know, ephemeral resource or some other thing like that. But you have some confidence where you can turn it into something. And then when you're troubleshooting that error later, you can reconstitute it. And I think that is a more obvious way to do this kind of thing. But I could also see situations in which that structured logging allows you to sort of, in a less brittle way, in a less encapsulation violating way, check to make sure that the internal state of things mm-hmm. is what you expect it to be without creating direct dependencies from the tests into the internal parts of the code.
And I think that's a special case of what I was talking about right at the beginning, which is to say, you know, again, the internal state in this instance is whether mm-hmm. the cache was hit or not. And it's yeah. just a way of exposing that internal state without making it either in the face of the caller or having to add a whole metric subsystem specifically into that cache and say, did the mm-hmm. last thing, all those kind of things. So it's a really nice way of, yeah, like kind of side channel attacking mm-hmm. the internal state yeah. of your, yeah. you know, and slightly better than, you know, like having the other sort of, I guess, is it an anti-pattern? Let me see what you think. You know, how many times have you written something that's like, you know, get cache for testing, the function that, which is, you know, like you look at it and you say, this uses the same functionality as the real test function. Sorry, the real cache function, but it does return that tuple with all this extra information about it. And you're kind of like, you look at it and you say like, I hope that I don't have a bug that is represented in the untested cache get function that isn't in my, for testing cache. And you kind of look at it and you go like, it's three lines. I think it's fine. Or, you know, sometimes you can implement one in terms of the other and hope, fingers crossed, that the optimizer throws away the fact that in your not test version, mm-hmm. you always discard that kind of side channel and therefore, you know, it all goes, it nets out. That's a nice way of doing it. But, do you think I certainly think of it anytime I write a test that has for testing in it, I do die inside a little bit, but sometimes it's a necessary evil if I haven't.
Yeah, it's not great, but if I have to choose between adding a little bit of extra complexity to my code and not being confident that it works, I'm going to go with a little complexity is worth knowing that it actually works.
Right.
But if there's a way to do both of those things at the same time, or do it in a way where that sort of surface area of the for testing is not only smaller, but also useful for other things.
Right.
In which case, that's a better way to do it.
It loses the for testing at that point, right? It just becomes, it is just like, hey, this is a window into this class that is useful.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
And the metrics exemplify that. Metrics and or structured mm-hmm. logic. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. No, that's cool.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of all we had. I mean, I was going to say, that's all we had planned, but we had no plans. We were just talking. And then we're like, we should probably record this. So here we are.
We could talk about metrics some more. I have lots of ideas.
Well, let's do that.
Good ways to
let's do
metrics.
That then. Yeah, I didn't want it to like peter out awkwardly here.
One thing that I debate a lot is the sort of, I would say, the difference between push and pull metrics. So let's contrast two systems in particular as examples here. So one of them that is kind of top of mind for me recently, actually, is a system like StatsD, right? The way StatsD mm-hmm. works is you have a centralized metrics collection service, and you create, and there's clients that do this for you, but just describing how the protocol works. When you have like a metric, like a counter that you want to increment, or maybe a gauge that it's like, yeah, the disk is like 96% full, then you create a very small human readable text snippet, which is like, I think it's like the metric name and then a pipe and then a value and then a pipe and then like the type, whether it's a gauge or a counter or something like that. I think that's roughly the StatsD thing. And then you put that in a datagram and you send that datagram off to your central collection server and you have no idea whether it got there.
Right. And you mean like literally a network packet, a single network, fire and forget network packet, UDP.
Yes, UDP datagram just goes whoop. And the idea is that this is really useful for metrics where you don't want to block the sender, right? Like you don't want the sender to be like, oh, I'm waiting to send this metric somewhere. But if it doesn't get to where it's going, it's maybe not the end of the world, right? So that is sort of one style. And there are other ways to, you know, maybe make that a little bit more reliable. And, you know, certainly if you use gauges and things like that more frequently than counters, you can get like pretty reliable statistics out of that. But one of the great advantages of that is that the senders or the receiver doesn't need to know that the senders exist. You can have a situation where it's like a new system comes up and it starts publishing its metrics. Yeah. And the receiver is just like, oh, I guess I have a new thing that I need to worry about.
Right. Cool. It just receives a datagram from someone else and goes, new client, fantastic. Right. And then there's exactly one piece of configuration, which is in all of the clients where the aggregator is, the one receiver is. Got it.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So that's the push base. You're pushing out.
Yeah. And then you have systems like Prometheus, where the way Prometheus works is you've got an endpoint. I think it's usually an HTTP endpoint. I think it has to be an HTTP endpoint, actually. Could be wrong about that. But you got some endpoint that's in your program that is being monitored, right? That is being observed. And the Prometheus kind of scraper reaches out to you on some periodic basis and says, like, give me your metrics, right? Mm-hmm. And so internally, you can have a thing where it's not like blocking the hot loop of any part of your execution. It's just sort of stashing the metrics in memory to be available the next time it comes around. But it's just taking this sort of like periodic snapshot of what is going on with the metrics, right? Now, I'm not even talking about like the actual metric collection internally, because there's like a billion different ways to do that. I'm kind of just talking about like, okay, assume you have a program that's got application level metrics. How does it get to somewhere else other than that machine?
Right.
And I think these are the sort of two basic ways that, that I've seen people do it.
Absolutely. Push and pull. I mean, we've talked, I think, about various UDP-based systems before. I mean, we had one at several companies ago that I know you worked on, which was a metric collection system that was more of the UDP datagram-based thing. Obviously, StatsD is an example of that. It has a lot of benefits. You mentioned the configuration is straightforward. It's non-blocking for some definition of non-blocking in the publisher. I mean, sending a UDP datagram is kind of a heavyweight activity in some worlds. But it's straightforward, relatively speaking, and certainly the StatsD format is very straightforward. So you blast it off. Obviously, the drawbacks are it might not get there, which reminds me of a joke, which I tell you, but you know it's about UDP. I don't think you get it. It might not get there. If it does, if the collector is down or misconfigured, you'll never know. You're just sending it out into the ether, literally. And there could be a bottleneck if you're generating a ton of statistics back to back. If you've got like if you try and update your counter on every single update, then you're sending a blast of relatively heavyweight packets at a machine, and that machine has to be able to deal with all of that data, and in fact you might back up trying to send it. So those are the drawbacks, but it's very, very appealing because also if you're a very short-lived application, if you're like a command line client, you might not live long enough to be scraped by a different system.
Then
let's talk about the pull-based systems, and let me just read that back to you. So in this instance, somehow some centralized system has to know about all of the places that have metrics.
Yeah.
And then it is responsible for connecting to them in turn or however, and saying, give me a snapshot of your metrics, please, over HTTP or TCP or something like that. Mm-hmm. So obviously the pro points there are the collection system is responsible for the period upon which it is collecting these statistics. So it could be like, well, I can do it once a second or once a minute or once an hour. It doesn't matter, as long as, you know, I can configure that in one place. And you're not being swamped by millions of intermediate values because you only care about it on the cadence that you care about. The drawback is, how do you find all your clients?
Right.
That sounds relatively common. Now I've got another problem. So yeah, okay. I've just read those back to you, but obviously you brought this subject up because I believe you probably have opinions, and I'd be interested in your opinions on those.
I do have opinions. I do want to make the point, though, by the way, about sending the datagrams, is that you don't have to do that in process. Just as with Prometheus, you're going to store your metrics in memory and then it's going to get scraped. You can also store your metrics in memory and then send them out with some cadence over UDP, right? Like, you can that do them in sense, line. Yeah. You don't have to. Right.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. But I am a huge fan. One of the sort of scary bedtime stories that finance dads tell their kids is the story of Knight Capital, and Ooh. how a trading firm lost hundreds of millions of dollars in 45 minutes, something like that.
Yes.
And it's a terrible story. And it's funny because I worked with somebody who actually is very familiar with this
process,
was directly involved with some of the mm-hmm. companies that cleaned up afterwards anyway. And it's funny how much of this has turned into sort of like lore and
folklore. Yeah.
You know, it's been the game of telephone has been told many times, but it is nonetheless true that, like, one of the problems that happened there is that they had software running that they did not realize was running, right? They didn't realize that it was doing what it was doing, right? And I generally feel like I sleep better at night knowing that there's a central server. Everything that is running is at least trying to publish to that central server. And if something comes up unexpectedly, there's at least a chance, probably a very good chance, that those messages will suddenly appear on that central server, and it will have the ability at least to detect that something is running that should not be running, right? Mm-hmm. You can kind of do a little hybrid of both of these things if you want. You can have, like, you know, the central server then reach back out to the sending clients. It can even, like, give them like an aggregated ACK where it's like, yeah, I've received 300 messages from you in the last minute or something. Like, just so you know, I'm actually receiving your messages. You can do things like that. But the thing that really makes me sleep well at night with a lot of these systems is having a way so that if someone were to start a piece of software, like on their desktop or in some test server or somewhere else, it would at least try to tell someone about it, as opposed to, well, it hasn't been added to the central configuration, so there's no way we could ever know.
Got it. Yeah. I mean, there are different ways of solving that problem. Obviously, because, you know, again, if you try and reach out to a server, but it doesn't come back to you, mm-hmm. you still have this problem, right? You know, and in the finance worlds that we're talking about, we have very strict network segregation, which means that you might not be able to send the ping mm-hmm. to the central servers to say, like, hey, I'm a production machine. Yep. So there's issues of that nature like that.
Yep.
And so I feel that, like, there's always an incomplete part to this. There's always a slightly of a blind spot here because in general, a service discovery mechanism that's robust to these is useful whether or not you're pushing information to a centralized server or whether or not you are being scraped by some centralized server. And mm-hmm. that seems to me the thing here is you're saying, like, if you're sending these periodic metric pings to some system, you could notice that something was alive and doing something that unexpected. That's kind of begging the question of, like, why are you using your metric system to determine the liveness of software? Why don't we have a software liveness indicator?
Oh,
maybe
sure.
You are talking about that as well here, but
yeah, I'm kind of like, I'm talking about this in the context where everything is already broken, right? It's sort of like both of these systems work great when everything works great, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, when they break, what are some of the different ways in which they break? And you're absolutely right that it's like network partitioning is one way in which the sort of, like, push-based model, you know, the STATSD model doesn't save you, because it's like, you have a test server that's configured and running in prod, and it can't reach the test network.
But then, you know, so there's another potential here, which is if we don't use the fire and forget single UDP datagram thing, mm-hmm. and you have instead the TCP connection, then obviously yeah. you get the positive connection
yeah.
that you are talking to the centralized server, and you get your ticket from it that says, yes, you're okay to run or whatever, you know, those kinds of things. Yeah, but then you are sort of solving the similar problem to, excuse the dog. You are solving similar problems to, and now I can't even remember what the thing's called now. What is it we use for service discovery at the old company?
Console.
Console, yeah, which yeah. is, you know, a chubby in Google terms, I think, is the equivalent. And, you know, it's a centralized lock manager, but it's sort of a small amount of shared state between things. And so people mm-hmm. can go in. And now, obviously, that's still opt-in, and you still have to be part of the console cluster, or you have your system has to be registered with the console cluster in order for it to be noticed. But that's what it's supposed to be. That's one of the things it's meant to be there for, is to say, like, hey, find me all the things that say that they are metrics producers, or mm-hmm. everything that says I'm a web browser or web server, or that kind of thing. And mm-hmm. so that feels like a good solution. But just like my network partition example and the whatever, you can still break it, because if you're not in the console cluster, then you're in a partitioned world of your own, right? And so, yeah, there's not an easy solution to any of these things. But I do wonder if conflating metrics gathering with this is a good thing, whether or not, you know, you just mentioned in passing that this is a useful thing to be able to do. It certainly is a surprise if you get
this is one of those things where it's like, this is not a real solution to the problem that you're talking about it being. Like, you're like, we have A and B. We're trying to choose between A and B. And I'm like, I think I like A better than B. And I was like, why? Yeah. Well, it's like, well, because in certain situations, it'll solve this problem. It's like, well, but in other situations, it won't. It's like, yeah, but that's not why we're talking about A and B. I'm just trying to pick between two options, right?
No, that's really interesting. Yeah, yeah.
So it's just,
yeah. Yeah, no, I got it. And I mean, ultimately, it's almost like, what if you were to do, if you're doing metrics gathering, the hybrid solution where, you know, instead of proactively being scraped, you just connect into the central server mm-hmm. and then it asks you. So it's still push and pull, like you connected into it and it knows that you existed, and you therefore service discovery is, if you tell net to port 8000 of this central machine, then we care about what information that you have. But you get scraped by it saying, okay, give me what you got. Mm-hmm. But obviously that doesn't work over HTTP, which obviously has convenience methods. Certainly when I'm a developer, it's useful to be able to hit my own web server. And in fact, some of the tests I wrote involved scraping back over the HTTP port to check that I was actually exposing the metrics that I thought I was exposing when I was writing my own Prometheus endpoint. So I think, to say that the Knight Capital legend was purely, and not that you did, but like there were so many other aspects to that. It was very much the Swiss cheese, and eventually all the holes lined up and one of the things got through. But yes, metrics.
The real thing here is sort of bringing this back to observability in general a little bit, is like, I do this in the systems that I have. What you probably want to do in a system that has discovered that it is no longer observable is to stop. Agreed. Because it's sort of like the last gasp of like, someone pay attention to me.
Yeah.
Right. And so you want to do that in multiple situations. You want to probably have something like that at startup, like registering with some sort of central discovery service, or sending out some sort of message saying like, hey, I'm starting up. And if you don't have a way to acknowledge that someone heard you, be like, okay, well, then I guess I'll stop then. Like having some mechanism to do that is a great sort of safety mechanism.
Along with heart beating to make sure that everyone both ends are still actually there. And like, are you still there? And I don't just mean TCP level stuff. I mean, actual application
level. Level heart
beats. Are you there? Yes. Okay. I'm back. Yes. And just that kind of stuff. That's always a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And then one of the more interesting ones, and I've had some debates with people about this, but I still think this is the way that I do it, is if you have a system that encounters a fault. So going back to our sort of structured logging, like I've logged an error or an exception, and I try to send that to somewhere to notify somebody, right? What happens when that fails?
Yeah.
I think the right thing to do with a certain amount of retries, like keep retrying, but like if you retry for some period of time, eventually you probably just want the system to stop. Now, that's not universally true for every single system. There are things where it's like, no, this just needs to keep trucking, even if it's having failures. Yeah. But all other things being equal, my base argument is if you have a system that has an error, fine. Errors happen. If you have a system that has an error and tries to report it, its error and it can't, okay, it should keep retrying. But at a certain point, it should just exit.
I would not disagree with you on that. I mean, but just to sort of like remind the listener, though, that, you know, you and I come from a world of finance where there's a lot of regulatory stuff around. If we can't log what we're doing, or if, you know, again, night capital type stuff, if we can't tell somebody that something is up, then the best course of action is to stop doing anything further. Log everything you can to disk and then kill the process and be done with it and hope that that get someone's attention, right?
Right.
Why are we not trading anymore? Oh, it turns out the process self-destructed. Why is that? Well, there's been a network split and it can't tell us that the position's out, you know, those kinds of things. And those are more defensible. But yeah, if my pacemaker can't log an error, then maybe I don't want it to stop. You know, obviously
I don't want my home Wi-Fi router to turn off because it can't send logs to some place that I don't care about the logs for, right?
That's exactly. Yeah. So there are ways, but I think as a sensible, and even within the finance industry, I think, you know, this is something that I've worked on desks where it is okay to not be up and running. Like it's not great. You know, people, there's going to be some very long meetings that you're gonna have to explain yourself, but it's like not in the, if you're not on and trading, the only thing is an opportunity cost. You know, you weren't able to make money or whatever. And there are manual ways of trading out of positions and those kinds of things. But if you have obligations to an exchange or downstream clients, then maybe you have to limp on and say, look, it's better for us to continue to be able to provide this service, albeit disrupted. But I've never worked on a situation like that. So I'm always down with yes. You know, like literally my C++ exception handling stuff is like log everything you can to disk and then kill -9 myself. Like, you know, there's no way we can carry on after this point here, right? We are done and dusted. I don't care if like the destructors don't run properly, just kill the process at this point. And that's always okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I tell you though, just to tie this back to testing, because why not? That's where we started.
Why not?
The one piece of code I've never really come up with a great way to test is the code that kills the program.
So there is, at least in a C++ framework I'm familiar with, there is a death test, and it works by forking the process and then communicating between the two processes to make sure that this actually kills the process. Now, unfortunately, Unix being as complicated as it is, there's signal handling and there's like child parent relations, and you can still not always get it right. But it's not a bad way of saying this should abort the process, right? Literally kill the process and be done with it. And you go, well, okay, I'll fork myself here, no snickering in the back, and the child process will do that, and then the parent process monitors to make sure that that's what happens through some, you know, Unix domain thing. So you can write tests for these things. There's never an excuse not to write a test for something, he says. Very well aware that I've just spent the last 2 weeks writing very limitedly tested code, but that's a whole other story for another time. All right, friend. I think
That's probably a good place to call it, right?
Yeah, this expanded from a I have an idea to 40 minutes worth of conversation, which is how it should be, and I've really enjoyed it. But metrics are more useful than you might think, and you should keep them. And structured logging is always a choice too. So
yeah, it's a choice, that's for sure.
All right, friend. Until next time.
You've been listening to Two's Compliment, a programming podcast by Ben Rady and Matt Godbolt. Find the show transcript and notes at www.twoscompliment.org. Contact us on Mastodon. We are at twoscompliment@pachyderm.io. Our theme music is by Inverse Phase. Find out more at inversephase.com.